Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 227 for comics originally released on December 14th, 2011. Now, starting us off in DC is a new number one. It's The Ray number one. This is one of four. It's a mini-series by Justin Gray, Jimmy Palmiotti, with art by Jamal Igel. And, I mean, with a creative team like that, I was really looking forward to this. And I think not only did they delivered more than I frankly expected.
It was a really good first issue.
It had everything,
everything that I expect from a first issue, good action, great art by Jamal, you know, great continuity. There were some just really unique scenes and things that they did, you know, with the light-based powers that I haven't seen before. And, you know, just it was action, and then there was a lot of fun added in on top of it.
It had a nice sensibility and tone to it. I think fun is a very good description of it. I mean, this is a complete reboot of The Ray, or at least it's a new version of The Ray, I should say. Because at first I wasn't sure if this was going to impact any past history of the Freedom Fighters and related characters, if they even exist in the new DC universe. But the first page kind of implies that this guy isn't the first hero to use the name.
Right, so... and you know, they cleared that up right away. You know, it's just like, well, I don't, you know, something like you can't, I don't know if you can copyright superpower names that no one's, superhero names that no one's coming after me yet, you know, so it's like he's not that Ray. He's not supposed to be a reboot of that Ray. There is somebody else called the Ray, you know, but this is a new character.
Yeah, but we don't know the details of that, because I'm wondering if the Freedom Fighters is even going to be on this Earth if they go with a multiversal kind of an approach. But regardless, I mean, they at least address this is a new guy, and I mean, they do some really fun stuff. The art, I think, you know, again, Jamal Igel just knocked it out of the park. The only quibble I'm going to have with that, and I do not blame him because I think he did what he set out to do. Man, that last page, a little gross.
No, when I saw that, I thought of you.
Yeah,
John's
yeah.
Not going to like that.
I mean, it told what it needed to tell, showed what it needed to show. I just would have rather it didn't, you know? But, I mean, even that, I mean, it's art I really enjoy looking at. To me, this is kind of, you know, classic comic book art in all the right ways. And I loved how this issue did such a great job setting up the main character, showing his origin, covering that initial growth curve, learning curve type stuff with his powers, and really kicking off the first major adventure. I felt that, I mean, I'm not quite sure how much time this really covered, because some seem to be in flashback, whatever, but a lot happened in whatever that time frame was. And it wasn't just the hero. I mean, we got to know his supporting cast.
Yeah. Well, it's purposely skipping around because, you know, and he even says in his narration, you know, I don't know about, you know, other people, but I'm not going to, I'm telling the story and I'm not going to focus on me bumbling around, you know, so he like kind of skips over a lot of those figuring it out kind of things, you know, beyond the, you know, the initial foray.
But we see enough of it to really get the sense that he has to learn aspects of it. He's learned a few. We don't see all the details, but it's still covered, and it felt like he didn't just go from never having the powers to suddenly he's got them to he's just mastered them. There is that, like you said, that implication without getting into the nitty-gritty of okay, he had to figure out how to, you know, reflect off the water to go back up to San Diego or whatever. You know, and I also liked how they gave a really solid sense of the high-level general gist of the powers without being too specific. And it's okay, it's light-based powers. It works kind of, sort of, maybe along these lines, and he's still figuring it out. And, you know, because he's, I guess, thinking at light speed, he may be able to do some tricks or whatever down the line. I mean, they set stuff up pretty well without it being he can fly, you know, X miles per hour. He can do a laser beam of this intensity, you know, and tossing numbers to it or something. The only part where I felt this issue was lacking, and it was something that did kind of jump out at me, was when we see him back at his job at the lifeguard tower. Because up until then, he couldn't wear clothes because his powers are like burning him off or whatever, and now suddenly he's back to being a regular Joe with the lifeguard thing.
And I'm assuming that because, you know, right after that, he was talking about how he figured out how to manipulate the light to make things look like a costume or whatever. So I'm assuming he's just manipulating the light, some kind of holographic image, to make it just appear like he's wearing his lifeguard uniform and that he has regular skin and all that kind of stuff.
And that may be, it seemed like he was going with the glowy thing and a few of those things to cover the fact he wasn't doing it quite right. I don't know. I mean, it wasn't an Achilles heel or anything.
Well, I was thinking that there was, because that was right around the point where, you know, there was that skip forward, you know, that he's now learned a bunch of stuff.
Well, it was after that, because it was about the fourth page from the end, I think, where we see him back there. Because we saw him talking about being able to dummy up the costume and some stuff like that. But even after that, when he's seeing his girlfriend, he's still there with the serving plate or whatever in front of him.
No, but after that comes the part where he's flying around battling those jellyfish, and the narrative thread there is that he's pretty much figured out what he's doing. And then you see him as the lifeguard again.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair, because it covers the whole yoga and meditation and stuff.
Right.
So, I mean, it was one of those that was very much implied, and I didn't feel like, oh, wait, this is unfair or anything. It just seemed to... it was the only thing in an otherwise very, very smooth issue that was even the least bit of a bump for me, you know. And I'm really hoping that the rest of the miniseries is going to be kind of as packed with great story and art as this issue was, and that we're going to see more of this character after the miniseries. I mean, I was really pleased with this.
So I didn't have the bump. I didn't have any problem with this issue, and it hit the 5 out of 5 for me.
I'm going to give it that 5 out of 5 because if every first issue were this way, I would be just so happy. I mean, I felt like I totally got my money's worth out of this. It sold me on the character, the concept, the supporting cast, the whole nine yards. I can't think of anything else a first issue, or really any issue, should do that this failed to do. So these guys should be very proud of what they've done, and I hope they keep up the great work.
Move on to Avengers X Sanction number 1.
Yeah. Now, you're not really into the X franchise at all.
Not into it at all is correct.
You're kind of pulling out of the Avengers franchise.
Correct. I have actually disengaged from the Avengers franchise at this point, with the exception of Avengers Academy.
Understandable.
But I at least know about, because I've been reading Avengers up until about last month. I'm more unaware of X-Men, I mean, other than I know who the major X-Men are and stuff, but I'm not that up on all the details of X stuff. You know, like, I mean, I'm aware of that there was a series called Ascani Sun or something like that. So when they make the reference to Ascani, I kind of know what that means, but not really, you know. And whoever this alien dude Cable's talking to, I don't really know what is going on there. I'm like vaguely aware of, you know, the circumstances around this, but
well, you know, the high level stuff about Cable, but never really read any of his titles. Therefore,
right, correct.
Blacksmith and stuff is going to be a little bit lost on you. I can see that. I guess the other question I would have going into this, Jeff Loeb, I've had mixed feelings on him as a writer for the last couple of years. Him and McGinnis, I had certain expectations of this going in based on some of their work on Superman, Batman, and stuff. How does that creative team usually click for you?
They're okay. I mean, I've liked some Jeff Loeb stuff more than others. And McGinnis, I'm fine with. Some people really love Ed McGinnis, and I can understand. He's more of like, he's okay. As far, I don't love him. I don't dislike him. He's kind of, you know, he's an okay artist.
Okay.
His characters are a little blocky for my taste.
He's got a clean style, but a bit of a pronounced style, and I got a little bit of a love-hate relationship with his art at times. Sometimes it's really great. Other times it's a little over-inflated. They seem like they're totally pumped up on steroids or something.
Yeah.
This didn't have that, but I can definitely see your comment about the blockiness of some of the characters or whatever. To me, the big thing here was just the storytelling style that Loeb uses was not really firing on all cylinders for me. It was pretty much what I had expected, but both in a good way, bad way. I mean, Loeb tends to write these roller coaster ride kinds of stories that are great unless you think about it too hard, at which point they kind of, you know, shatter. And I enjoyed this issue, but there were a couple of things that just puzzled me. You know, starting off with them fighting the Lethal Legion, which we haven't really seen as a group in ages, including the Radioactive Man. And I had thought after his stint as a hero in the Thunderbolts, he'd like gone back to China or something like that. So I was surprised to see him having busted out of the Rast and getting into this big slugfest with the Avengers. Again, wasn't a big deal, but it was something that made me stop.
You only thought something happened because when they were done with him on the Thunderbolts, they just locked him back up in some sub-basement of the Raft.
Apparently. Could be. I guess.
He had to escape. That's why he's all mad now.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing though, with the storytelling style is a lot of these pages have four, maybe five panels. It's a bit of a loose, lighter weight story kind of a thing. And as far as the art goes, I mean, by and large, it was very good. The one place I actually said just, hey, wait a sec, this doesn't make sense to me. If you go to the page opposite the Avenging Spider-Man ad, right before we get to the two-page face-off between Cap and Cable, got a page with four panels there. They're setting up how Cable's, you know, technovirus thing is going out of control. Top panel, or, you know, in this thing down at the bottom, it's spreading. He flinches in pain, accidentally tossing his gun. Okay, fine, because I was wondering on the next page how Cap got a gun, since he usually doesn't carry one. And in this, on that last panel, the gun is drawn in front of Cap. Cap's between us and Cable. So it's like Cable has just thrown the thing way beyond Cap, and next panel, you know, or in the next page, double page splash, bam, he's got it kind of a thing. You know, again, not a huge deal, but add to that the shifting color on Cap's costume and stuff. There were enough little things like that that weren't really bothering me, but just kind of niggling at me, that really didn't help this story in a lot of cases. It, you know, it wasn't a big deal, but like I said, it weakened the art. And you've got a lightweight story, kind of, oh, the Avengers are just happening to fight these guys. Cap goes off, you know, chasing, you know, it lacked tightness and yeah. Sensibility.
Well, that same sequence, you know, so Cap, right before the page before the one you were talking about, Cap throws a shield, it banks off that pillar, hits Cable in the back of the head, and then ends up
in front of Cable.
Between Cable and Cap. Cap is about to pick it up. Then I assume Cable's head's exploding or something on the top of this page. Cap is like flung back, and then all of a sudden Cable's got the shield in his hand. I didn't quite understand what was going on there. I didn't know if Cable was blasting all this lightning bolts out of his head on purpose, or if that's one of his powers now, or
I took it to be a telekinetic blast.
Okay, because so he does that, and then all of a sudden he's got the shield. Given that they spend three entire panels with Cable kind of just standing there with the shield and the gun, I don't know, him picking up the shield maybe could have been a story point that they could, you
they
know,
could have made room for that if they
a panel
had to
or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the sorts of things I'm talking about. I mean, it's you can pretty much figure out what's going on, but you've got to kind of fill in a couple of the things that really should have been on the page. The part, though, that frankly offended me a little bit was the final panel of the story, where at this point it's very clear that Cable's mission is to save his daughter, or his essentially adopted daughter, Hope, because the Avengers, you know, are responsible for her death. He's got to go kill the Avengers. I mean, that's the whole thing. We know that going in. And this end, it's like, do you really expect us to believe at the end of this that Cable just killed Cap?
No, and that's I didn't like the ending for that exact reason, because
it's insulting.
It's a cheap, I mean, maybe there's someone who's gonna say, "Ooh, I'm gonna come back and see how Cap gets out of this." And it's like, it's the kind of 1940s cliffhanger type of thing where you know it's a cheat, you know. So why bother doing it? You know, it's just
exactly.
It's insulting, I think. But, you know, that's just me. I think other people might not have a problem to that. I just, in general, McGinnis's art, I have a real problem with just the consistency of spatial relationships between things from panel to panel. That last page is a good example. Look at the top panel.
With the
Cable
gun.
Is holding the gun, and it appears to be in front of Cap's head. It is certainly not pressed up against his temple, right?
Because you can see the
barrel passing. It's in front of his forehead.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so why would you hold the gun like that anyway? And then a couple panels later, it's clearly against his forehead. You know, and the same thing when the shield was getting flung around. You know, you see one panel where it looks like the shield is, this is a couple of pages earlier when Cable flings the shield at Cap. And maybe it's just the crazy perspectives he's using. But in one panel, it looks like the shield's flying at a downward angle. The next panel, it looks like it's flying at an upward angle. Then it looks like it's, you know, completely parallel to the floor when it's stuck into the wall. And it's just, it's all over the place. These are little details that, you know, maybe they shouldn't bother you, but
if you're lucky,
just,
though,
it's
you
little
notice
things like that that take away from the, for me, the story flow. And I mean, when things are consistent and you don't notice them, then you're just swept into the story and you don't notice this stuff. But when you start noticing that kind of stuff, then it's kind of a problem.
Well, but when they're inconsistent and you don't really notice it, it shatters the believability of the story enough that you do start to notice it. You know what I mean? It's
yeah. Well, believability in the context of, you know, cyborgs from the future shooting telekinetic blasts and all the other kind of stuff.
And carrying a gun.
And carrying a gun.
And I don't remember the last time.
Telepathic blasts aren't good enough.
I don't remember the last time, you know, Cable's gun ran out of ammo.
Well,
just, yeah.
Maybe he's got a, if he was smart, he'd have some kind of little palm print recognizer in it so someone else can't pick it up and shoot him.
Well, I can see what the problem is. It's a six shooter.
Yeah.
Seriously, if you look at the same panel you're talking about with the shield getting flung back and forth, Cap's trying to shoot the empty gun. It's got a rotating barrel at the front of the gun. So that gives the bullet, presumably it's a bullet, I don't recall seeing.
Looked like
it
an energy blaster when that big double page spread, that certainly
yeah.
doesn't look to be a projectile. You know, it's like, not only is there a giant
but does that not look like a revolver?
A cloud of
beginning?
Energy on the shield, but there's a giant cloud of energy coming out of the barrel of the gun, which would seem most inconvenient, you know, from backwash.
Yes, yes, that would seem most unfortunate. It just looked like a you know, revolver kind of a chamber or whatever at the beginning of the gun, or end of the gun, I should say.
You know, I look at this story as this is a great book for people who like this sort of thing. You know, it's
well,
just like,
that's
all I can say is it wasn't particularly my cup of tea. I didn't hate it, but there's really no reason I can think of why I would want to read issue number two.
I can understand that. I mean, for me, I was expecting kind of a light, almost wacky roller coaster ride sort of a thing. That's pretty much what we got, but I usually want a little bit more than that out of what I'm reading. This was not bad, but it was not great. I don't think this is going to make anybody a fan of the X-Men or the Avengers. Maybe of Cable or Cap. Don't know. But for me, it was not a stellar start to the status quo shattering epic, you know, that's going through 2012 of the Avengers versus the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was a 3 out of 5. People who are fans of the creative team should certainly check it out. But it's not something I think people just definitely have to go read. They're fine skipping it.
Yeah, I give it a 3 out of 5 also. You know, I'm kind of on the, you know, it's just, it was there. You know, I read it. I didn't dislike it. But, you know, boy, you know, given that I've dropped the Avengers stuff and I'm not reading X-Men, there was nothing in this issue that made me want to pick up either Avengers or X-Men.
Yeah.
You
missed
know?
Opportunity there then. Because they should have, I mean, this is the sort of thing that should get people excited about both franchises.
Okay, next up we've got Atlas Unified number 0. This is a kind of a weird issue. I mean, it was listed on the you know, shipping list for the 14th of December. I got an issue because listener was kind enough, they know I love Atlas stuff because I did that back issue spotlight on Atlas, so they picked up a copy of it for me at New York Comic Con, and sent it my way. And, you know, so I've got one. It's got the New York Comic Con logo on it and everything. The one that's listed online as having shipped on December 14th does not have a New York Comic Con logo on it. So I'm assuming that there is supposed to be a zero issue out there that went to regular comic shops. However, when I went to my local comic shop on the day that it came out, and he usually gets everything. I mean, you like get stuff like Pope hats from Ad House Books, you know, he gets everything. I didn't see any copies of it. And he gets Grim Ghost and Wolf and Phoenix and the other Atlas books. So I'm not sure that it actually did come out. And I know you looked around town in Austin and couldn't find a copy either.
The experience I had is I realized I had started ordering with number one, not number zero. So it's like, I need to go find this locally. Now I've got a couple of choices. Normally I'd just go to like Tribe and they'd be able to help me out. But let's face it. This is a fairly obscure kind of a book to a large degree. So I only had a limited time. I figured, you know, I really haven't seen any of the Atlas books over at Tribe. So maybe they've got them. Not saying they don't. But I'm going to go to Austin Books because they're one of those stores that carries a lot of independents and, you know, has a wider selection. And sure enough, they had Phoenix. They had Grim Ghost. They had Wolf. So I was able to get a lot of issues I needed there. I couldn't get Wolf number 3, but I was able to read those. No sign of Atlas Unified. And the irony is, I did that on Saturday before I'd realized I hadn't gotten the Atlas Unified. And I'd seen Omega Paradox, which has a group of characters, independent book, you know, team kind of superhero thing, whatever. So I'm going, realizing I need to get the stuff. I'm had also seen another book that I wasn't sure if I needed or not. Couldn't get cell phone connection while I was there at Austin Book Saturday. So I wound up going back out on Tuesday thinking, great, I know exactly where the Atlas Unified is because I thought the Omega Paradox was that and the other book. Go in there, it's like, oh, they don't have the Atlas Unified. Arrgh. So I go and ask, do you have? Because it's like, well, I want to have it so I can review it. They not only didn't have it, they pulled it up on their computer. They couldn't find any sign that it even existed. Yeah. Because, I'm not entirely sure why.
Well, I think this is pure conjecture on my point, but when the series Phoenix came out, right, mm-hmm. there was a zero issue that came out at last year's New York Comic Con, you know, the 2010 New York Comic Con. And again, one of the listeners got me a copy of that and sent it to me, but I had actually ordered a Phoenix number 0 from DCBS and it never came, and I ultimately got credited for it. I don't know that they ever actually shipped. I'm relatively certain that they never actually shipped Phoenix number 0 to comic stores. So it could actually be the case that Atlas Unified number 0, while it existed as something that they sold at the con, is not necessarily something that ever got shipped out to stores, which, given that you asked the store and they went looking for it and couldn't find any evidence of it, it is maybe reasonable to assume. So
but it makes it hard to read their books, yeah. If I can't find their books.
The other thing that's, you know, kind of, you know, so they have 3 books that they have coming out so far based on, you know, the Atlas characters. They've got Wolf, they got Phoenix, and they've got the Grim Ghost. Now, the Grim Ghost, all 6 issues of the Grim Ghost have come out, and I've read them all. That story's completed. It was written by Tony Isabella. I kind of had some concerns about it at the beginning. It was an okay series. Not the best Kelly Jones that I've ever seen, but he's only doing pencils, and he's inked by somebody else, so, you know, maybe there's some issue, you know, because it kind of just doesn't look Kelly Jonesy.
Yeah, it looked a little more cartoony than I felt, you know, kind of fit the material. It was decent art, though.
Yeah, I think something's being lost in the translation with the inking a little bit there. Because, you know, when Kelly Jones did that long run on Batman or has done runs in other places, I mean, he usually inks his own work and it has a certain look to it. Anyway, so I read that whole thing. I got those 6 issues. Wolf, on the other hand, you know, I have the first 4 issues of it, And issue 4 ends with a to be continued coming next month, you know, number 5. And they got a picture of number 5 that's supposed to have been out in November. And, you know, Grim Ghost number 6 came out in November. So, okay, well, it should be out. I never got it. I had it pre-ordered at DCBS. And the same thing with Phoenix. You know, Phoenix number 4 ends with a, you know, to be continued. And, again, they've, you know, all indications is there's supposed to be a Phoenix number 5 coming out, cover dated in November. And no evidence that those books have ever come out. And, in fact, I got credited for them by DCBS, which tells me that they got canceled through Diamond, because the only time DCBS will credit me for something is when Diamond cancels the orders.
I've seen a couple of times.
Or when it's really, really old.
They've canceled stuff that I have not seen Diamond's on the cancellation list. So, and it could just be that I'm looking at the monthly cancellation list. They're getting more frequent updates that I haven't really factored into my whole number crunching system yet.
So, in any event, I did some prowling around the internet, and I could find no evidence that Phoenix number 5 or Wolf number 5 were ever published. So, you know, and maybe it's not that big of a deal since Atlas Unified number 0 does not appear to have been officially released through comic shops either. So, yeah, you know, as far as that goes, none of that stuff seems to have hit mass distribution.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff's very much flying beneath the radar. I'd gotten like the first issue of Phoenix, but didn't really continue with it. And I picked up these things at San Diego. I had a really nice talk with Dean Zachary, artist on Phoenix, and I am blanking on the other fellow's name. He was in the same booth, though. I talked with them for quite a bit. I mean, they're great guys, and they're doing some great work here, but they're just not getting into the stores. They're not getting seen by the readers.
Yeah. So, anyway, I mean, it's, you know, Atlas Unified number 0. I have a copy of it. Came from New York Comic Con. It's kind of interesting because they've got little vignettes with trying to set up kind of a big crossover kind of thing with the different characters from Atlas, although they've thrown in without any kind of explanation what appear to be two extra characters, you know, because it does say joining together Atlas's past, present, and future. So I've got, you know, I see the Phoenix. Well, we know he's one of the Atlas present, right?
Yeah.
Then they've got a page with Cro-Mag the Killer, who's some kind of, you know, Tor or Korg or, you know, Turok, you know, kind of, you know, caveman. Not Turok's not a good example. You know, like a caveman barbarian kind of character.
Right.
Now, this character, as far as I'm aware, never existed in the 1970s Atlas comics, because I have all of them except for two issues of Vicky, and there was no Cro-Mag. I recall. Maybe I'm drawing a blank and he was in like one little story somewhere.
It could have been something they were going to do as their next title, but
yeah,
never published.
Anyway, so that one's there. And then on the next page is Scott Galland Starwalker, which again is a character I'm not familiar with. So that one seems to be a new character. And then they've got Sergeant Hawk, who did appear in the Atlas comics. They've got Kid Cody, who was in the Atlas comics. They've got Wolf, who was one of the current series. Then they got Vicky, who was the teen reprint comic that they did back in the 70s, which is kind of funny that they threw Vicky into it. She's, you know, kind of sitting around on a beach in a bikini, and, you know, that was kind of an interesting one. And they got Luke Ballone Manhunter, who was in the Atlas comics, and the Grim Ghost, of course. And they do a little bit of, you know, connection, you know, something happens to Vicky and she ends up meeting the Grim Ghost, and then the Phoenix, you know, is there, and, you know, there's, and, you know, it's mostly set up. And the challenge that I find with the whole Atlas Unified number 0 is they're kind of throwing these different characters into this mix. And for people who don't remember the 70s series, which I've got to imagine is about 99.7% of people reading comics today, you know, there's kind of, you know, like only a tiny handful of us who ever read and remember that stuff. You know, it just seems like you know, I think it's pretty cool myself, but boy, there's not a lot here that's going to be drawing in somebody who's not familiar with this stuff.
I can see that concern, and I think it's a very valid one. One of the things I will say they've been doing fairly well in the other couple of titles, I noticed it very much with Wolf, but also picked up on it in Phoenix and Grim Ghost. At the beginning of each issue, they kind of reset the scene, reestablish the character, give the premise, that kind of stuff in a story page, which made when I, because I couldn't find Wolf number 3. So when I got to number 4 and this Iron Jaw or whatever was in there, you know, I'm assuming he showed up in the third issue, don't know, but I was able to get back into the story having missed an issue. So while I think if they're banking on nostalgia bringing people into this universe, I'm a hardcore comic fan. I know zero about the whole Atlas universe prior to this stuff. So nostalgia, not really coming in for me. I think you're in the vast minority here, being a big fan of that older stuff and coming back to it. They've got to get a new audience. I think they're doing some things right in terms of accessibility and stuff like that on the story. They're not getting the market penetration, so it's not really out there. It's hard to find this stuff, which makes it all the less likely somebody's going to know about it, talk about it, and get somebody else interested, you know?
Well, it brings up a kind of a general conversation topic. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I thought that, you know, the Atlas Unified Zero in and of itself was, it was an okay issue. You know, but you know, it's a zero issue. So it's mostly going to be set up, you know, you bring a bunch of things in, you got a little bit of detail there. I mean, I'd give it a 4 out of 5. It wasn't, you know, wasn't something that like I was, you know, wow, that's the greatest thing I ever read, but it wasn't bad. Right. I think that me having read this stuff before, it's going to give me a vastly different opinion of this than someone who hasn't. But with relaunches in general of old properties, I mean, we saw it when they tried to relaunch the Gold Key characters at Dark Horse.
Yeah.
And what are some of the other ones they've tried to relaunch lately?
We've seen the Archie superhero line try to get relaunched a couple of times.
Yeah. I mean, it's just you try to relaunch the Justice Machine. From Moonstone, you know, which they tried to relaunch, and apparently the orders weren't sufficient to even put those out as single issues, and now they're soliciting it as a single hardcover that's got the whole story. You know, it's just you've got these characters that are unfamiliar to the current audience. They are not from Marvel or DC, but even Marvel, you know, they relaunch and they, you know, kind of booted the relaunch of the cross-gen stuff, you know, with Mystic and Ruse and Sigil. I mean, again, it's like characters that are not familiar to the current readers, and readers do not seem to be interested in general, you know, at least by looking at the sales and looking at how these relaunches do. I am not sure that relaunching an existing property that does not have a substantive fan base is going to put you any better than just giving up and trying to start over with something new. You know, like I think that the story that they told in Mystic, for instance, from Marvel, kind of going off this path here for a second, but I mean, it had nothing whatsoever to do with the cross-gen Mystic. They could have just as easily made that something else and tied it somehow into a planet in the Marvel universe, and they might have actually gotten a little more interest to it.
I mean, I see your point there. While it was a reimagining of the property, I think both in the case of Mystic and Sigil, there were enough connective aspects to the original. You know, in this, with the case of Mystic, the magic, the two sisters, it went in a very different direction. They were younger characters, etc. But I'm not going to say it's like they just took the name and nothing else.
Well, my point is they took little enough,
yes,
that they didn't need to make it a reboot. They could have taken that same thing and made it something completely new.
They didn't leverage enough to justify reusing the title.
Exactly.
Whereas you're right, they could have spun this into some other title and tied it into the main universe and done essentially the exact same story.
Whereas the Atlas relaunch stuff, all these characters are recognizably the same characters that were in the original books. You know,
No, I don't know, so I'll take your word for it.
They are. And, you know, I think that, you know, like even the Dark Horse relaunches, right, of Gold Key, they were largely the same character. I mean, they updated them and changed, but they were recognizably Magnus and Turok and Dr. Solar.
Yes.
Right. But, you know, if you're going to do the relaunch and use the name, you should make them recognizably the same characters. Because why not, if you're bothering to do the relaunch? But I guess the thing is like, people don't seem to be that interested. I won't say people, but I mean, you know, the people who are reading these comics in comic shops on a monthly basis, who are, you know, the audience for this kind of stuff. And what needs to be done to kind of pull in a wider audience to this stuff? Because they don't seem to be sustaining these series on that audience, because that audience is, you know, they're buying the DC relaunch, they're buying, you know, a zillion Marvel and Avengers and X-Men books every month, and, you know, all these double ships that happen. I mean, they're pretty much keeping the comic shop fans' wallets locked up. And when somebody is going to go away from that, is this the kind of stuff that they're going to be looking for? That's the question I have.
I think that's a very good question, something I'd certainly like to hear what our listeners have to say on. But you take a property that has a huge, or at least at one point more recently than the Atlas stuff, had a huge following, and that's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That was the top-selling non-Marvel DC title in November, and it did 33,482 units, which is about a third or less of what it did, what in this case it was season 9, what season 8 had done by that third issue, because it was number 3 or whatever. My point there being, even something that has a huge audience, doing it as a comic book, now granted, Atlas started as a comic book, so, you know, that at least gives it the advantages of having fans that are comic book readers. But having a large audience, doing a comic book, does not translate to getting the sales. It's, I don't think, a matter of, is it non-Marvel or DC? Is it new? Is it not popular? Whatever. I think part of it is where comics used to be an easy sell of, you know, you could go pick up that Star Wars comic from Marvel for, what was it, 30 cents? You know, the $3.99, $4.99, you know, whatever cover price on some of these, or even the $2.99. You're getting a fraction of a story. It's hard to find these comics, just a comic store in general, much less something like an Atlas Unified, where it seems to evade being found. It's an uphill battle. I'm not surprised they're having these problems, and I think every time a relaunch fizzles, which we've seen a number of, it makes it harder and harder for the next one to be successful. You know, it's not so much a self-fulfilling prophecy, but with the whole Justice Machine thing, it makes me a little less likely to want to go buy a Moonstone thing, because are they really going to come out with it? So I see where the problems are, but man, I don't see where a solution's going to come from on this.
Yeah, and I mean, the Atlas stuff, I mean, it's had a rocky start. I mean, it's not bad stuff. I mean, I think that they've put out some decent comics. But I mean, boy, there were huge gaps between the early issues. You know, they didn't come out monthly. You know, there were 2-3 month gaps between issues. Issue 5 just doesn't show up on a couple of the series. You know, it's just hard to, you know, keep that story continuity. And, you know, I think maybe launching into a crossover at this point, maybe not the wisest thing to do.
Putting an ad for that in the first issue of Phoenix, I think, was a mistake. That's why I stopped pre-ordering the books. It's like, I'll dip my toe in, but oh, wow, you're going to cross your entire universe over, you know, within the first year? That's more of a commitment than I was willing to make at that point.
If you recall, one of the things that was kind of the jump the shark moment back at Valiant was a big crossover of all the books.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that even cross-gen near the end, they started having that big, building towards that big crossover, and that was pretty much the death knell there as well.
Well,
it's almost I mean, there are other reasons, but it's just, it's kind of coincidental that when these companies start having the big crossovers, you know, it's like things are never the same again. You know,
well, and it is funny how many seem to die in the midst of doing their first big crossover or one of them. Yeah.
Malibu, that happened too, didn't it?
No.
I thought they had a big crossover like Breakthrough or God Wheel or something that was like,
oh,
one
for
of
the Ultraverse.
Ultraverse.
I was thinking
stuff.
The actual Malibu line, which is
I was thinking
that.
Of Malibu Ultraverse. I think they.
That made it through Breakthrough. They got bought by Marvel. They relaunched with Black September. And went for maybe 6 months as it fizzled.
Yeah.
Marvel did the same thing to that they're doing to cross-gen right now.
Yeah. It just seems like these crossovers are a last act of desperation to try to bring in people or something. I don't know. It just, I'm not a big fan.
I get the desire to cross-pollinate the readers of all these titles against each other and stuff, but it's starts to feel like an obligation to your existing readers. It doesn't really pull in new readers for smaller companies to be doing this. And really, you should be focusing on each title standing really strong alone. Because, I mean, as I was reading these couple of titles from for the Atlas stuff, I mean, Phoenix was fun, really good. I was enjoying the art and stuff. Grim Ghost, didn't really think that the art kind of fit the material as well as I would have liked.
The story was decent, though.
The story
I mean,
was good, though. It was getting better and better.
The story, Tony Isabella in that one, he actually put a lot more subcontext and depth into the story and the universe and the interplay between the real world and the fringe than ever existed in the original comic.
Yeah.
You know, he did a good job there. And I'm really liking Wolf. And in fact, Wolf is kind of cool because you are cross-pollinating Atlas characters in this series because you've got Wolf and in comes Iron Jaw and you've had, you know, Sam Lomax, the cop. He was also an Atlas, you know, he had a series. He appeared in, I think, Police Action, you know, back from Atlas back in the day. And, you know, you have these different characters that you're using in the context of Wolf. You don't need to call it Atlas Unified, you know, it's just,
yeah,
you know, bring the different characters in somehow. I mean, and it's kind of funny because the way that they crossed Vicky into the Grim Ghost in the issue zero of Atlas Unified, I mean, they could have just as easily done that in an issue of Grim Ghost.
Yeah. Well, and I think if they had been doing that for a while and it started to feel like a cohesive universe, then doing those kinds of events makes sense. But when the first event is when these characters first meet, that kind of makes it a little awkward. So, I mean, for me, Wolf I thought was really good, but frankly, a little grosser and a little more violent than I would care for in a few places. But even so, it was fun. So I think that it's unfortunate this Atlas relaunch hasn't seemed to have found yet its foothold in the marketplace, and I hope it survives long enough to get a chance to do that. But
yeah, I mean, it's good stuff. They've just been plagued with getting the, I guess, probably mostly, and I'll, again, conjecture on my part, but it just seems getting the orders from the comic shops and just getting these books into the hands of the fans, you know, has been the sticking point.
They're doing competent professional work, and it's just not got the visibility in the marketplace to really have a shot, I think, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. It's different, but it's maybe, I don't know if it's not different enough or too different or whatever, but it's just not getting the comic shops to order it.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to, you mentioned that you had grabbed Omega Paradox number one.
I've read that. Let's talk about that as a bonus book real quick. This is one that I read the Zero issue when it came out back in August. Zero recollection of it, not a good sign.
I picked this up and the Zero issue both at the shop, so I kind of read them in a row. So,
okay.
Not a lot of story thread carrying through from one. I guess in the Zero issue, they're looking for this pointy-haired doctor guy. That's in the first issue.
Okay.
And they just, I forget, Quintoro is his name, the guy in the robe. And I guess they find an imposter one. And, you know, at the end, you've got this guy in the hood, which I forget what his name is, saying, you know, enough. You know, we have to find the real Quintoro. He's the key. And then issue one, of course, picks up and they're assaulting this skyscraper, it looks like, and you know, they actually find Quintoro and bring him in. The art is wonderful. I mean, Mark Sparacio, he does really nice art. I really like his art. He's kind of the Greg Horn school of, you know, kind of very, very rounded, painted looking, you know, very, it's appealing to me. Not everyone likes this art style. This is an art style that I really like, this kind of art style.
Yeah, it's got a sense of depth to it. You know, it feels a lot more three-dimensional than a lot of other artists.
The thing that I have a trouble with in this is I read this and I read it two times and I just don't have a clear understanding of what the heck is going. Why are they after Quintoro?
Yeah.
What is going on? And the characters, I feel like some of them have some powers, but you know, with their names and power sets are not introduced well enough. And I think that Ian Ng could have done that potentially by, you know, putting some little more directed narrative, at least upon this, the female character, her name is Solara, the one in the brown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she's assaulting the thing, you know, she could be kind of thinking about what the whole deal is that they're trying to do. You know, you could be having the running monologue in her head that could just bring everybody up to speed. And that's not what happens. And in fact, you know, what you get instead is, I hate the city. It's cold everywhere, tortured rock, nothing lives here, blah, blah. And it's like, maybe, you know, he's trying to build some characterization from her, but that's not what I need at the beginning of the first issue. What I need at the beginning of the first issue is her internal monologue setting the scene and telling me what the heck is going on.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned some of those captions on that first page, because that was one of the things that I really took notice of, and I felt, for me, put this issue off on a bad start. Because those captions, the content, you know, regardless of that, they felt too big, the font was too large. You know, it automatically, not automatically, but it gave the comic, at this point, a little bit more of an amateur feel to it than, frankly, I was expecting. And I felt this way on a few other Moonstone books. It's like they don't really know how this is going to print compared to, you know, regular Marvel, DC, or really any other comic.
Yeah, the word balloons, they really need to do the word and capture balloons with the giant white balloons with the font that they have and the text size. They need to look at, you know, some Dark Horse and Image books and Marvel and DC books and stuff and see how they're doing word balloons. Because, I mean, I look at other books and they have the white balloons, but the font is not quite so big. They're varying, you know, like you got some of, you know, normally you see things where they like boldface various words for emphasis. So use italics every now and again. They just do things to vary it. And that is not being done in this book. Now that you bring up the word balloons, that is a valid point.
Well, and also the top panel of the first page is an establishing shot, but nothing overly impressive in terms of what it's showing. Then we see her boots and stuff, and I'm like, well, you know, if they're not really going to show me much character art, that's got me a little worried at this point.
The first page should have more than a cityscape and a main character's boots.
Yeah.
In fact, page number 3 would have been a great page number 1.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And when I got to the second and third page there, the art was really impressing me. You know, it's like, okay, this is looking pretty good, actually.
You know they could have taken page number 3, made it page number 1, and added, you know, some captions on it with like an internal monologue to, you know, set the scene for what's going on in the issue and carried that into those captions into the next page where we got the 2-page spread. And you would have gotten this issue off to a, in my opinion, what do I know? I mean, I'm a reader, but I mean, I think you would have gotten this off to a much stronger start.
Well, yeah, because on the first page, I'm thinking this is amateur. The second page, I'm thinking, okay, this is getting a lot better. But, you know, there's no dialogue on that third page. There's one line on pages 4 and 5, and I'm like, wow, this is getting pretty minimalist. Is there going to be much story here? You know? And it winds up getting a lot better throughout. I never really got a sense of who the people were on the team, the names, the powers, or anything like that. But it was at least pleasant to look at, but every so often I would hit this one or two things, and I'm like, ouch, that really hurts. And if you look at the Hot Flips ad a couple of pages in, this is an incredibly pixelated ad. And I'm like, the production team for Moonstone should be embarrassed by this. Now, granted, it could be the problem of who they got the art from wherever, but still.
It's like whoever the Hot Flips guy sent too low res an image, you know, for that.
At which point they should know enough about how it's going to print to kick back and say, hey, this isn't going to cut it.
The ads are an interesting thing to talk about in and of themselves. I like, it's funny because you got, you know, Comic Supplies, you got mycomicshop.com, great yeah. site, love buying from them. And then you get a lingerie ad.
Yeah, that one took me back.
I don't know that I've ever seen a lingerie ad in a comic book before. Okay, I like seeing a pretty girl in some lingerie. What the heck, you know? Not sure that a lot of people reading this comic are going to have much occasion to be buying lingerie, but okay. You know, then we've got this Creator Chronicles ad. It's a, you know, interesting ad. I checked it out. Then we've got another comic shop, you know, kind of thing. It's just, I liked the ads in the book. It was a change of pace from, you know, the standard ads I see in comics. But
it was kind of odd to see the selection, particularly the lingerie one. The other thing in this book that kind of got me was a page flip before the lingerie ad. We got a double page splash of the hanger at their base or whatever.
That seemed like an ineffective use of a double page spread.
It was unimpressive art, but the big problem wasn't the art. It was, why this moment? You know, it was the wrong story moment to linger over.
That's what I mean. I mean, you got a bunch of people walking away from the ship in this shuttle bay. Really, nothing's happening here. And there's no caption. So you're not using all this landscape to move the story forward, because it's almost like a story moment that didn't really need to be told, and to devote two pages to it, it seems like a waste to me of a two-page spread. And even from the standpoint of selling original art, right?
Yeah.
You know, you sell original art, you can sell a two-page spread for some decent money. I collect original art. I wouldn't buy that two-page spread.
It doesn't showcase.
I would buy page three, you know, where Solara's jumping down and crashing into the building. That's an impressive thing. You know, where Solara's, you know, maybe not where she's just crouching, but if, you know, yeah. when they're having this big fight, you know, you go a few pages back, the one page before the Hot Flips ad, the center panel on the right page. I mean, that mm-hmm. would have made a decent two-page spread. You know, it's just,
yeah.
you know, there's a lot of moments in this story that, you know, at least four or five that would have made a good two-page spread, and this just wasn't one of them.
Well, the thing is, it doesn't even showcase their vehicle very well, because we've got a bad angle on that. There's there's nothing happening in the background. There's nothing to kind of soak in on this. And that's kind of how I felt about a lot of this issue, is aspects of it were very well done, but other parts were, frankly, a little amateurish, and frankly, I blame the writer for a lot of this.
Well, you know, I'll go against that, though. I mean, I think that Ian Ng is I think a new writer. I haven't seen a lot of stuff from him. I think an editor should be
That's
giving
fair.
Comments like what we're doing. Hopefully we're being constructive here. I'm not railing against this book.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a bad book. I'm trying to give, you know, and as are you, I think, trying to give constructive feedback on this book. But this seems to me to be the kind of comments that an editor and an art director
yeah.
should be providing to this team as they're putting a book together, as opposed to something that we're saying, you know, reading the final product.
Yeah, well, and that's certainly my intent with every review I do, is to give constructive feedback. And that's why I try to point out, gee, you know, I don't think this was the right story moment, or things of that nature, just like you're doing here too. And I certainly think the team behind this, from the writer, the artist, the production people on up and down, show in a number of places they could do really well, and in a few other places they just, it's like a swing and a miss. And I don't think it would have taken that much work for them to have really tightened this up and delivered, frankly, a much, much better product. You know, I mean, again, the artist shows good sense of anatomy, decent sense of scale, good sense of the consistency of the environment, things like that. A couple of things here and there could be, you know, tweaked and improved a little, but I'm certainly not reading this thinking that this is just amateur hour, you know, left, right, and center or anything.
I read it, I think, you know, it's great art. I love the art. You know, again, some of the choices could use a little work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that that's where a strong editorial hand is something that would vastly help improve, you know, these kind of stories. Because sometimes I read stuff from, and I won't name the publishers out of courtesy, you know, but there are some publishers in the back half of previews that put out a decent number of books that, you know, you open the things up, and once you get past the pretty cover, you know, you're thinking, yikes, you know, this art is,
in fairness,
really.
We felt that way stuff in the front half of previews, yeah, from time to time also.
True. But, you know what I mean? I mean, you look through some of these things and you're like, you know, wow, this really looks like, you know, if it was something that, you know, a couple of guys put together in their garage, I could see, you know, it. But frankly, there are books that people have put together in their garage that look better, you know, but that's not the case here. I open this up and the inside looks every bit as good, you know, as far as just, you know, craftsmanship of the individual images, let's say, as anything that I see on the stand. But the some of the choices and the story flow and panel-to-panel story flow, that's the kind of stuff that could use a little bit of work, and that's the kind of stuff where some art direction and coaching and things like that would really help.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I was flipping back to the inside front cover, and Lori G. does editorial. There is a art director listed.
Well, editor is listed up above as Joe Gentile, who's also the editor-in-chief.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, he's like one of the top guys at Moonstone. So, you know.
They just need to tighten up a little bit in a few areas on their production stuff, specifically the lettering, the captions we talked about. Some of the stuff they're doing at Moonstone I'm really liking. But some of it just falls a little shy of the mark. Some of it just doesn't come out that often. I mean, I think we both really liked Captain Action when it started, but it was, you know, 10 pages of that and, you know, maybe another 10 or 12 of something else every so often at, what was it, $3.99?
Yeah, I think, and maybe I'm not remembering correctly, but, you know, the Captain Action stuff that I really enjoyed was art by Mark Sparacio, who's doing the art on this.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. I think you're right.
But then, you know, there was like 10 pages of that in an issue, and then there was, you know, some other stuff that wasn't to my liking.
Well, it wasn't Captain Action.
It wasn't Captain Action, and the art wasn't clicking with me in the same way.
Now, I only ordered the Zero in the first issue through DCBS, and I'm on the fence if I'll continue with this or not. I thought what was here was fine. The story didn't really grab me by the throat and say, oh, it's got to be on my pull list, but it didn't put me off either. So it's as much a factor of, do I have too much to be reading as it is as anything else? To me, this was a 3 out of 5. It was an average comic. I think it could have been better, but I don't think it was horrible by any stretch of the imagination.
I'm in the same place on it. And again, in the story, it didn't really hook me. The art, you know, the art did. I love Sparacio's art. You know, this is the kind of thing, I haven't pre-ordered it either, but, you know, it's the kind of thing that's generally on the rack at Comics, Toons, and Toys. So, you know, if I see issue 2, I'll pick it up and look at it, and there's a decent chance that if I'm not completely overwhelmed that week, that I'll buy it.
Well, if you do and you like it, let me know, because Austin Books, again, this is the exact kind of thing that they have on their racks, because they tend to dive a little deeper into some of the indies and stuff than a lot of comic stores.
Okay, cool. Very good.
So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I read another issue, number 1 this week, that I thought was pretty decent. It's from Dark Horse, called The Strain. It was only $1. So if people like a vampire story, It's kind of a, it's not, there was nobody on the first issue that was like overtly a vampire. I think it's going to end up being a vampire story. The characters on the cover look kind of like vampires. Oh, actually, it does say vampires. And the inside says, they've always been here, vampires, in secret and in darkness, waiting. Now their time has come. In 1 week, Manhattan will be gone. In 1 month, the country. In 2 months, the world. It's Guillermo del Toro and Chuck Hogan's The Strain. Now, this is written by Dave Lapham. And, you know, so the first issue is a lot of setup, but it was intriguing. It really kind of caught my attention. And given that it's only a buck, I think that if people see a copy at their store, if they like, you know, horror / vampire kind of things, it's worth checking out, especially for a dollar.
Cool. And that's why it's so smart for them to do dollar first issues. Yeah. And stuff like that is, it's got me on a couple of things I wouldn't have tried otherwise.
I would have been reluctant to pick this up if it was I absolutely wouldn't have picked this up if it was $3.99. You know, if it was $2.99, maybe. For a buck, it's a no-brainer, you know, and it's a 12-issue series, I think. So, again, I would recommend that anyone out there who likes these kind of books give this one a try. It's a very low investment.
Cool. I still have not read, frankly, most of last week's stuff, much less this week's. So I have read nothing that we haven't already talked about.
Okay. So
that pretty much do it then.
Does it for me.
Cool.
Oh, and hopefully, you know, anyone, you'll be listening to this if you read when it first goes up, the day after Christmas. Hope everyone had a great holiday. And if there'll be a thread by the time you hear this on the forum for people to kind of talk about and put pictures if they want of whatever kind of holiday swag they got that is related to comics and, you know, stuff like that. So if you got anything cool you want to share, I always love to see what people are getting. Go to the forum, check it out, and share with us what kind of neat stuff you got for the holidays.
Yeah, and even if you didn't get anything new, if you finally gotten around to reading some trade or something that you've been wanting to do for a while, and now since you got a little extra time off from work and stuff, got the chance, tell us about that too. So, cool. That do it then.
Does it for me. Join us next week when we discuss Batman Incorporated Leviathan Strikes from DC, New Mutants number 35 from Marvel, The Activity number 1 from Image, and Memorial number 1 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.